Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. Each week, we endeavor to bring you stories from reporters' mouths, from the people who report on these stories, stories that you will not hear on the mainstream media, stories that just don't pierce through the insane amount of craziness that we're living through with the Trump administration. You can support that effort by going to ROFpodcast.com, becoming a member. We amplify stories that need amplification. We look into stories that have been unheard in other venues, and it gives you an opportunity to get a sense of what's going on besides just the headlines. And of course, we always analyze those headlines and dig a little bit deeper than people get to on television or normal radio. So support the program. Go to ROFpodcast.com and hear the full show. Plus, you get access to our archives, which go back over 10 years now. Bobby Kennedy in interviewing people, Mike Papantonio interviewing people, me interviewing people, guests that are sure to impress you and teach you something about the world. ROFpodcast.com. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on the show, American prospect columnist Adele Stan will join us to discuss the details behind Facebook's smear campaign directed at George Soros. David Lindorf from The Nation magazine will explain why there's no accountability at the Pentagon when it comes to federal tax dollars. As always, Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to recap all the news that matters most this week. And climate expert Michael Mann will be here to break down the federal government's dire warning about climate change. Don't forget, you can go to ROFpodcast.com, sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this program. That's ROFpodcast.com. So, Heather, I want to get to the final results of the midterm elections a little bit later in the program, because as time has gone on, and as you know, those results became even more dramatic. You know, time obviously makes them a little bit less so, had we gotten these results on the night of the election, I think the media narrative would have been dramatically different over the past now, I guess, 3 weeks almost. But we will talk about that later in the program, because it's ultimately the implications of what that brought about for the near term and in 2020 as to what it says about the future of our politics. But in the short term, the activity essentially the Trump crime docket was rather intense this week. There were multiple stories sort of almost following two different tracks, one dealing with Manafort and another dealing with Jerome Corsi and Stone. And then they converged in a sort of like third track in a story from The Guardian about Manafort meeting with Julian Assange. We'll talk about that. I want to put a pin in that for a moment, because that story we don't have as confirmed as at least what's going on here. And what I'm talking about is the essentially the collapse of the Paul Manafort plea deal, which, as you know, Heather, was a massive plea deal. It basically took all of Manafort's assets, something like $42 million, which pays for the entire Mueller investigation. It involved Manafort essentially giving Mueller everything And if he ever held back, if he ever lied, then Manafort would not only be dealing with the charges that he found guilty on, but be facing other criminal counts that he hadn't yet been tried yet. And this week, Heather, the deal falls apart. Tell us, what's that about?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we had expected Manafort to be sentenced just before Thanksgiving. And they came in at the final moment and said, we need 10 more days, and the judge granted it. And a lot of people, you know, who follow this sort of thing said that was weird, that, you know, to just ask for a 10-day extension meant that something was happening. Now, you know, the assumption on a lot of people's part was that this was, you know, meant that there were indictments coming down. As it turns out, and there had been some reporting to this effect, that Manafort was not being cooperative and that the Mueller team was getting upset. So we kind of knew that that was a possibility, but I think we were all sort of, you know, going, you know, hoping against hope that it was something less, less complicating, that they were actually going to be indicting a few people and that they were waiting for the sentencing for those indictments to come down. But as it turns out, it was that, and it was that the Mueller team came in and just said, he's been lying to us. And, you know, you cannot do that. You go into a plea agreement with a cooperation with the government, and you say that you're going to cooperate. If you expect to get a sentencing reduction or any of the other kind of appeasement, you're going to have to cooperate 100%. They say it very clearly. You cannot lie. You've got to tell them everything. They basically own you at that moment. In fact, prosecutors call it, they're working for Team USA now, right? It's kind of silly, but that's what they say. So you're on the prosecutor's team from the moment you make that agreement. And we've seen evidence of that from others, you know, in this instance and in other instances. So it turns out Manafort's been lying. And we don't know what specifically he's been lying about, although the Mueller team did indicate that when they submitted their sentencing memorandum to the judge, which will ask for very harsh penalties for all of this, the lying may actually be added on to what they are claiming for him. And he's got a previous conviction, and he pled guilty to these other crimes. I mean, he is in, and as you pointed out, he's already forfeited all his property. I mean, it's millions and millions of dollars worth of property that he forfeited. And he is also within that plea agreement. He's subject to state charges on all of this that he has now officially pled guilty to. It was one of those plea agreements where you kind of went, there's no way this guy is not going to spill everything he knows, because everything is on the line, everything he owns, his future, and the fact that it really is kind of pardon proof because of this fact that he's pled guilty to crimes that can now, that evidence of his guilt can be applied to state charges in places like New York or I guess Virginia and others where he committed these crimes. So no one expected him not to cooperate, although it's possible that Robert Mueller did, because Manafort has been lying and cheating from the very beginning of this. He had a bail agreement and he violated it. You know, he was witness tampering. I mean, the guy has shown absolutely no indication that he's going to follow these instructions. So perhaps Mueller understood that this was going to happen. Now, the big complication here now is back in October, it was reported Rudy Giuliani was shooting off his mouth after too many limoncellos again. And he said, he mentioned that the Manafort team had a joint cooperation agreement with the Trump team. Now, that sounded very weird to a lot of people at the time, because he was cooperating with the government. And you don't do that when you have a cooperation agreement. Weirdly, though, there were a number of lawyers who also pointed out that in comparing the Rick Gates plea agreement, Manafort's associate who pled guilty months ago, and Manafort, there's one thing that was different between the two of them. Rick Gates had to agree that he would not share any information with any third party. That was left out of the Manafort agreement. Nobody knew why, seemed odd, but it was. So it's clear that Mueller knew from reporting, from Rudy Giuliani, you know, shooting off his mouth, and the fact that it was in that agreement. And by the way, it was brought up to the special prosecutor's office. One lawyer on Twitter showed his text messages or emails to the special prosecutor asking for comment about this, and they replied, we won't have any comment. In any case, they knew that Manafort was theoretically anyway, talking to the Trump team, and that Rudy Giuliani was telling the press that he was. Well, this week, the New York Times reveals this on Tuesday night. They reveal this in a big splashy news story as if they just discovered it. Those of us who've been following the story already knew that. But they took credit for it, didn't give credit to Reuters or any of the other people who'd been questioning this. And implying anyway, and I looked closely at the story, and they didn't say it directly, but the implication was clear that this was a big part of why Mueller pulled the plug on the plea agreement. I don't believe it. I think it's because Manafort was lying, and we don't know, again, we don't know what he was lying about, but we're going to get some information from this sentencing memorandum.
Well, now hold on for one second.
Although that may go under seal as well.
We got to take a break here. Because there's a lot, there is so much to unpack in just what you've said and going forward. But I want to do this, okay, as a little bit of a tease. The notion that the Mueller team was aware that Manafort, ostensibly going to become a witness for the state, more or less, was sharing information with the Trump team. The notion that Mueller was aware of that opens up some very, very intriguing possibilities as to what's been going on. And when we come back, we'll talk about those in addition to what you are suggesting about Mueller offering up the facts that must be determined as to whether or not Manafort broke this deal. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, Digby and I will address this stuff. And this is it, folks. This stuff, I think, is really the fulcrum of this investigation. We will tell you why when we return. When you're on a holiday, you can't find the words to say all the things that come to you, and I want to feel it too. On an island in the sun. Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Digby, when we broke, we had basically talked about what happened with Manafort and Mueller this week, and more or less broke from the last segment on a cliffhanger, which was the idea that Mueller knew that Manafort was going to share information with the Trump team while he was supposedly helping Mueller get to the bottom of this whole case under the auspices of a plea agreement. Now, if that's the case, why would Mueller do this? And the only other fact that we should throw into this mix is that Mueller is basically saying that Manafort broke the plea deal just days after Donald Trump had announced that, and his lawyer had announced that they had submitted essentially written answers to written questions, which presumably those answers were based upon what Trump's legal team knew about what Manafort was discussing with Mueller. And it raises the question as to whether or not this whole thing was, in some respects, maybe not option one, but maybe as a backup safety valve, a way of watching the president lie in his answers, right? I mean, tell me if I'm off base here, but it feels like one of those situations where I say to you, you tell me, Sam, I'm your professor, and you come to me and you say, Professor, I can't take the test on Thursday. Can I take it on Monday? And I'm a little suspect of you, but I say, okay, here, take the test. You take the test, and you go tell all your buddies the answers. They come in and take the test on Thursday, and I'm like, aha, I gave that first guy a fake test. And I gave a different test to these guys on Thursday, but they had all the answers from Monday. I mean, it sort of feels like that a little bit, isn't it?
Well, it would be one way to test the this idea that Manafort was sharing with Trump. I mean, right? You would feed him certain things that were false. I mean, you know, this is spycraft stuff. You know, you put out false information to find a leak, right? I mean, isn't that how that happens? That's how you confirm it. I mean, I don't know what the reason would be for them to do that. I don't know what they felt they needed to achieve, or if anything. I mean, it may be, too, that they just didn't care, that they went, okay, we know Mueller's going to share all this with Trump. That's fine. You know, that we're not trying to keep anything secret here. This is what we've got. This is what we're talking to him about. And, you know, if he wants to share that with Trump, so be it. Maybe it's just that. I mean, it's not impossible that they're not trying to keep anything secret. I don't know. But it's clear, regardless of, you know, whatever their motives may have been in that, or no motive at all, they knew. They knew that Mueller was sharing with Trump, and look, they've been dealing with this guy for a long time, and as I pointed out earlier, Manafort is an inveterate liar, and he has been a lying witness, a lying defendant, a lying suspect from the very beginning, and I'm sure that they have never trusted him as far as they could throw him. And we don't know what Manafort really is up to either. He is a very weirdly enigmatic character in all this, because he had everything to lose by not cooperating, and yet here he is.
Well, one theory I've heard is that Manafort knew that he was going to lose everything. Once he actually lost all the money, he had very few options. And so instead of having to pay for the legal costs of fighting a whole nother round of allegations in a whole nother court case, he took the plea deal knowing, or counting on, thinking he knowing, that he was going to get a pardon at one point. And so he's saving all of this money in legal fees, because at the end of the day, it's not going to matter, because he's going to get a pardon.
Well, he may think that, but again, this was a pardon-proof plea deal, because there are all these state charges that exist out there. And believe me, they're going to go after him. These are states that have the capability and the motive to do it, because he was committing all kinds of fraudulent acts. And, you know, he's going to go to jail anyway. I mean, he's been convicted on previous counts, and he pled guilty to this. He's going to go to jail. And then, you know, Trump may pardon him, but he is going to have some legal fees at the end of all this, and he's already forfeited that, apparently. I think there may be some gray area here. I'm not entirely sure whether or not I have the full scope, but from what I've read, just sort of superficially, the kind of plea agreement that he entered into with the forfeiture of all of his property, that is not recoverable by him. That even if he's pardoned,
that's my understanding.
Properties
too.
Are gone.
Yeah. All right. Well, Digby, look, we got to take a break. Join me again in the next hour, if you will. We will talk about the filing that Mueller will file to make the case that the plea deal has soured. Let's also talk about this big Guardian story, which, you know, is, if true, could be devastating. But it's a very strange story. We will talk more about that in the next hour. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with more. Coming up, the U.S. government's climate report looks bad for the future of the planet. We'll discuss with climate scientist Michael Mann. I'm Sam Seder. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio.
Hey, wild things you're doing at night. Trips to wherever feels right. Doing it all just to feel things. Drinking's enough of advice. Drugs just aren't suiting you right. You were just fine as a real thing.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. This past week, the federal government released a congressionally mandated climate change report that Donald Trump ignored. Here to explain what that means, climate scientist Michael Mann. So, Michael, this week, the fourth national assessment of climate change released by 13 agencies. Give us a sense of just basically what that is.
Sure. So this is a congressionally mandated report that is published every 4 years by this organization, or we should say it's a governmental body, the U.S. Global Change Research Group, which, as you allude to, consists of 13 different agencies, including NOAA, NASA, Department of Interior, et cetera, all of whom are involved in research that's relevant to our understanding of human-caused climate change. And so there's this congressionally mandated report every 4 years that describes, as best we can, based on the best available science, our state of understanding of climate change and its impacts on the United States.
So how is this report different from, let's say, something like the IPCC report? What makes this report any different from others?
Yeah, so this report focuses specifically on the United States and on impacts, both impacts that have been observed that we are seeing now and that we might expect in the future under different possible scenarios. It's much more focused on the United States in particular than the reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. And I would say that this report is really focused more on connecting the dots, really explaining in a way that's accessible to the public what the impacts of climate change are and what they're likely to be in the future if we don't tackle this problem.
Okay, and I want to get into what those dots are in a moment.
Yeah.
Because I think that is what is particularly unique about this report is it really does show on a fairly granular level what the implications will be of, and what they are now, of climate change. But before we go any further, because, you know, all we, you know, the coverage has been largely around this notion of 13 governmental agencies put this document or created this document. It's congressionally mandated. The executive branch has no option but to release it. They chose to release it on the day after Thanksgiving, which is a very slow news day, essentially, or at least people don't pay attention to the news on that day. And so the dynamic is between Donald Trump, who's basically said he read the report, it's fine, he doesn't believe it. But one of the things we keep hearing is that the reason why these people wrote the report is because they wouldn't make money talking about climate change. I'm sure you've heard this criticism, but give us a sense, like, these are people who are simply doing their jobs in these agencies and are simply talking about a factor that impacts what their job is.
No, absolutely. And in fact, this is a voluntary effort on their part. There are government scientists, but there are also many academic scientists who contribute to this report. And they're doing this on a voluntary basis. They're not getting paid for it. In, you know, the case of academic scientists, scientists at universities or in positions where they have to raise grant money to support their salaries, in a sense, they're actually putting themselves at a disadvantage because they're spending all this time on this voluntary effort. It's a labor of love. It's communicating the science and its implications to the public. But that's time that they could be spending writing grant proposals and doing other things. And so, as is often the case, when an accusation like that is made by Trump or those who support his policies, those sorts of accusations are typically made in bad faith, and they reflect what we call projection, right? The reality is that those who are attacking the report, the scientists trying to undermine the public faith in science, are actually bolstered by tens of, if not hundreds of millions of fossil fuel industry dollars that are behind this very well-organized, very well-funded effort to discredit the science of human-caused climate change and thereby do the bidding of fossil fuel interests who don't want to see us move away from fossil fuels to renewable energy. What is necessary if we are going to prevent catastrophic climate change?
All right, before we get into the specifics of the connecting the dots, what you called it, I mean, just give us a sense of, contextualize this fourth national assessment of climate change with the other three. When were those released? I guess it's every 4 years, but give us a sense of when they came out. And what's the change in these reports?
Right. Well, under Republican administrations, under George H.W. Bush's administration, for example, there were similar efforts to try to, you know, make sure that the report didn't get as much attention as it might otherwise. There were discussions, trying to prevent the release of the report, and ultimately that was deemed not lawful. It's congressionally mandated. It has to be released. Under the Obama administration, and so there was, I think, one... The 2014 report would have been released under the Obama administration. It was a sober assessment of the science of climate change. I'll tell you, here's the difference. It isn't so much the developments in the science, although there have been significant developments in the science. We're better able to connect the dots when it comes to the impact that climate change is having on extreme weather events, when it comes to the threat of global sea level rise, where just in a matter of a few years, the scientific community has literally had to double our estimate of how much sea level rise we could see by the end of the century. It's gone from about 3 feet to now we're seeing maybe 6 to 8 feet by the end of this century because we now are using more elaborate models that are better able to represent the dynamic nature of ice sheets like the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheet. We now understand that those ice sheets, the dynamic nature of them allows them to collapse more quickly and contribute to sea level rise considerably more quickly than we thought they could just a matter of a few years ago. So the developments in the science send a sober message about the threat of climate change, but there's something else that's happened. The extreme summer of 2018, the summer that we just went through, where there was an unprecedented spate of wildfires, heat waves, droughts, superstorms, floods, that we know were exacerbated by climate change. The science tells us that. But more than that, people can see it with their own two eyes. People now see the impact of climate change playing out on their television screens, in their newspaper headlines, in their social media feeds. And I think that's the difference. people can now connect the scientific evidence with what they are seeing.
Interesting. And also that much more disturbing because as we get, as it becomes more obvious, the situation becomes more dire and our ability, I guess the window for our society taking action, what we're watching is basically that window close, aren't we?
We're seeing the tip of the iceberg, right? If the impacts of climate change have become so obvious that we can now see them play out in real time in terms of disastrous superstorms like Michael and Maria and Florence, unprecedented flooding events in Houston and North Carolina, and, of course, the California no longer even has a fire season. California is a fire season now. And that, again, what that tells us is we're much farther along than we should have ever allowed ourselves to get. Because if we're seeing that already, there's a fair bit of climate change in the pipeline. If we're seeing that happen already, if the impacts are becoming so obvious to the person on the street, well, we've baked in at least another half a degree Celsius, another degree Fahrenheit of warming, and things will get worse. The question is, how far down this dangerous highway are we willing to drive?
All right. We've got to take a quick break. When we come back, we will talk more about this fourth national assessment of climate change, the dots that are being connected, and what in a better world we would have our government do about it. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio.
Heels of the critically acclaimed legal thriller Law and Disorder comes Law and Vengeance, the latest novel from famed trial attorney Mike Papantonio. Law and Vengeance follows the law firm of Bergman DeCatomas, who is now in the crosshairs of a weapons manufacturer. But this is not a law firm that plays by all the rules. Based on a real case, Law and Vengeance, the riveting new legal thriller by Mike Papantonio, is available wherever books are sold.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
We're back. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to climate scientist Michael Mann about the recent U.S. government report on climate change. So, Michael, when we broke, you had basically told us that folks around the country, presumably the world as well, are beginning to be able to see what the science has been telling us for years. And you also told us that those things that we are seeing are lagging indicators, if I understand you correctly. When we see that California no longer has a fire season, but simply is a fire season throughout the year, what we are seeing is essentially an indicator that we have already passed a certain threshold and there is a lot more that's already baked into the cake. So we're not going to be able to, regardless of what we do and how we respond to climate change, we're not going to be able to dial that back, right? I mean, California is, as it is now, we're not going to return to the California of 20 years ago, can we?
No, and Governor Jerry Brown, you know, said, hey, California, we have to recognize we're dealing with a new normal. It's worse than that. A new normal sounds like you've arrived in a new place, you just need to figure out how to deal with it. But no, it gets continually worse if we don't act. It's an ever-moving baseline, a baseline that's moving towards more drought, more extreme heat, more wildfire, for example, in the case of California. And you're absolutely right. It's truly irresponsible for us to have allowed things to progress to this point, because it's not reversible. These changes are not reversible on human timescales. What we can do is mitigate the damage, prevent worse things from happening, and arguably we're still sort of within our adaptive capacity. We're still sort of within the sphere where, you know, we have enough resilience to potentially adapt to the changes that are in store. Not an easy task when you've got 7.5 billion and growing people competing for less food, water, and space. So already it's an uphill challenge. But the experts who study adaptation will tell you we're probably still within that window where we can, you know, where civilization can survive if we don't worsen the problem. But the problem is another decade, even another decade of unrestrained fossil fuel burning probably puts us outside of that sphere of our adaptive capacity. And, of course, the ability of other life ecosystems to adapt to the changes that are happening and are in store.
So now, you know, we talked in the last segment about some of the response from the Trump himself, and frankly, the right, which tries to discredit these reports. There seems to be now, and this is a change I think that's taken place in the past five or six years, on the right, they no longer seem to argue about the existence of climate change. It is now they do not believe that it is caused by man. And I guess the point being that man can do nothing to reverse it, or I should say slow it, or stop it. And yet this report shows us the implications of climate change. How do we know that we can impact it? I mean, that may seem like a rudimentary question for you as a scientist, but I mean, for lay people, like, how do we know that we can impact it?
Yeah, and what you've seen is this progression from one stage of denial to the next. In fact, my co-author Tom Tolles, Washington Post cartoonist, and I, in our book, The Madhouse Effect, we mock sort of these stages of denial, from it's not happening to it's happening, but it's not due to human activity, to, well, maybe humans are contributing it, to, okay, well, maybe we're the dominant source, but it's not bad, to, hey, you know what, it's too late to do anything about it anyway. It's sort of an absurd progression, and there's only one commonality to each of those stages, that we shouldn't do anything about the problem. Isn't that convenient for the fossil fuel interests who have funded this disinformation campaign? That's all they care about, that bottom line. It doesn't matter whether you're denying that climate change is real or that it's caused by human activity, or you're denying that we have any agency in acting on the problem. And the science has a clear message to us, and that message is carried in this latest report, in the most recent report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that came out about a month earlier. There is still a window left to us where, if we can transition quickly enough away from fossil fuel burning to renewable energy, if we take immediate action now, and Paris, the Paris Agreement gets us about halfway there. It doesn't solve the problem, but it gets us halfway there, which means if we can ratchet up those commitments, the commitments of all the countries of the world, including the U.S., until Trump makes good on his threat to pull out of the Paris Accord, if we all make good on those commitments, we get halfway there. If we can ratchet up those commitments, we can see a path to stabilizing warming below truly catastrophic levels, often, you know, characterized as somewhere in the range of 2 degrees Celsius, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. We can still do it, but we need policies not only to get us to meet our Paris commitments, but that get us beyond that. Now, here's the good news. Despite Trump's efforts and the fossil fuel lobbyists and climate change deniers he's appointed to his cabinet and who are running his administration when it comes to energy policy, despite his best efforts to dismantle the progress that we've made, just based on what's happening in the states, in states like California leading the way, of course, what's happening with our largest cities, municipalities, and our largest companies, there is enough action taking place there that we are probably on track to meet our Paris obligations with or without Trump's help. But we've got to go beyond that. Paris isn't enough. We've got to do more.
Tell us about one or two of the examples of connecting the dots. I mean, where we see real practical implications of the change in the climate, and how you think that information can be used in everyday life as a way of communicating the urgency of what's going on.
Yeah, so we can take, you know, some of the catastrophic events that we've seen play out in We don't have to go any farther back than a week. Still we have wildfires in California, the Camp Fire, unknown number of people who have potentially died in that fire. It's the most deadly and damaging California wildfire in history, and that comes during a year in which California has also seen its two largest wildfires in history, one of which happened in the winter, what was formerly thought to be outside of the fire season. But expanding sort of summer dryness and heat is now giving us basically perpetual conditions that support wildfire. So the damage, the loss of life, what we saw happen in Malibu, the destruction of these homes, these iconic homes and communities, that stuff that's playing out in real time, we can step back and say, okay, well, these are unprecedented wildfires. And sure, there's a component that has to do with forest management practices, et cetera, and Trump and his lackeys have tried to dismiss these wildfires as a manifestation of those choices. But no, if you take that completely out of the equation, we've seen a tripling in the extent of wildfire in the western U.S. over the last several decades that is directly linked to the drying and the heating. You make the land drier, you heat it up, you evaporate more moisture into the atmosphere, the land gets drier, you raise temperatures, you make it hotter, you make it so you warm up the winters so that pests like the pine bark beetle can infest the forests and weaken them. You have more fuel for these fires. You get the unprecedented summer heat and drought. It all comes together in a perfect storm to give you unprecedented wildfires. We can directly connect those dots. It's climate change that is creating the conditions for these unprecedented wildfires, and we're watching them on our television. What we're watching on our televisions right now is climate change. Unprecedented wildfires made worse by climate change. It's the same thing with unprecedented floods like we saw play out last year in Houston and earlier this year in North Carolina with tropical storms and hurricanes that are stronger because of warmer ocean temperatures. They've got more moisture because of the warmer atmosphere, can hold more moisture. You get more rainfall out of it. The storms tend to stall when they make landfall. And even there, we think there's a climate change connection, the slowing of the jet stream, the fact that these storms aren't moved back out to sea nearly as quickly. All of that has come together to give us these catastrophic flood events. We wouldn't be seeing the extremity of these weather events in the absence of human-caused climate change. There literally is no question about that anymore.
Michael Mann, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. Always a pleasure.
Dr. Michael E. Mann is Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State University. He's the author of the book The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week that's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it.